Hello, I'm Yoram Chazoni, and this is NatCon Talk, where nationalism and conservatism meet. Today, I'll be speaking to John O'Sullivan, former policy advisor and speechwriter, to Margaret Thatcher, editor-in-chief of National Review magazine, and today, president of the Danube Institute in Budapest, Hungary. John O'Sullivan, welcome to NatCon Talk.
Nice to be here, Yoram. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. You know, it's at this point almost 4 years since you and I first met at that conference on the future of the conservative movement in December 2016. We had just been through Brexit. Donald Trump had won the American presidency, you know, just a few weeks earlier. And I and my colleagues organizing this first national conservatism gathering, we were looking for a keynote speaker, and you graciously agreed to come. I think you were the perfect person then, and you're the perfect person to talk to us now on the eve of the American election, almost 4 years later. I think almost everyone knows, but not all of our younger viewers know that you were the speechwriter, the principal speechwriter for Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. These days, as you know, there's a furious debate taking place between two groups that we could call them the neocons and the natcons. And the neocons have a kind of an official history of Reagan, Thatcher, Pope John Paul II. You yourself, in fact, wrote an entire book on just that, on the president, the Pope, and the prime minister. And that's the title of your book about Reagan and Thatcher and Pope John Paul II. And according to the received wisdom of so many writers these days, those were three figures who were sympathetic to a kind of a universal liberalism. Globalism is supposed to be the extension of Thatcherism. Do you think that Margaret Thatcher would have seen herself as a globalist, as this word is understood today, or would she have been on the side of the nationalists?
Well, we can answer that easily, I think. She gave a speech to the first International Conservative Conference. I think it was in 94, sometime like that. And she addressed this very question. She said she was in favor of economic globalization, but not of cultural globalization. She felt that she was happy to have as much free trade. That, after all, is part of the British tradition. It's not a single party's ownership. Most British economic commentary, because of the role Britain played in developing economic theory, has been in favor of free trade. But she didn't believe that we should abolish all national and cultural boundaries. She says that clearly. Somebody else who is worth calling on witness to here is Nigel Lawson. And I remember he gave a speech, probably the first attempt to define Thatcherism, in 1983 or 4 at the Carlton Club. And he says very clearly that Thatcherism is a blend of classical economics, of nationalism, and he has one or two other things, but that those two are the ones that count. And there is no doubt that Mrs. Thatcher was a patriot. Now, as you know, there's a lot of argument back and forth about what distinction there might be between patriotism and nationalism. My own view is that patriotism is a certain kind of nationalism, but there is no doubt that however you define these terms, Mrs. Thatcher was a nationalist and thought it was her duty to represent the British people, the guardian of whose interests she was. She would not have agreed with the famous remark of, I think it's Lord Burns, a very distinguished senior civil servant, who said he didn't think it was his job to maximize the welfare and advantages of the British people, but to do so for the globe as a whole. She would have thought that was utopian.
Well, so Prime Minister Thatcher finished her prime ministership in 1990, and within 2 years the Treaty of Maastricht had been signed, creating the new European Union, and Britain was plunged into it. Here we are now, a few decades later, And in 2016, Britain emerged on the other side with Brexit and reasserting its independence. Evidently, that experiment didn't work. What was your view of Brexit? Can you explain to our viewers how did you see it going in and how did you see it coming out?
Well, you should know that I actually campaigned against remaining in Europe in the 75 referendum campaign. Not many people still alive can claim that, but I'm one of them. Now, Mrs. Thatcher was, of course, newly elected as Conservative leader. She took over a party that at that point had nailed its colours to the European Union mast. She was not about to maximise her difficulties as party leader. And anyway, she hadn't reached strongly Eurosceptic conclusions at that point, namely 1975. But of course, her period in government made her increasingly Eurosceptic. Although she did some Europeanist things, notably the Single European Act, people often cite that as an evidence that she was not, that she was a strongly pro-Europe. In fact, that she was very disappointed in how that the results of that act turned out, because, for example, they were it promised to open up services to Britain throughout Europe, which it never really did, and that was one of the causes of her disillusionment. There is no doubt that she gradually changed her mind until, as I think Charles Moore rightly points out in his final volume, she really, and in other places, she was herself somebody who would have supported Brexit, because she concluded that all of the attempts by Britain put itself at the center of Europe and to exercise the kind of influence that and a country like Britain ought to have been able to do, they never really worked. And we were sitting on a train that was going in a direction that she didn't want to go in, didn't want to go to that destination of seeing our nationhood and our democratic sovereignty subsumed into a completely different state, in which was has many virtues, not a state really, a polity, has many virtues, but is not democratic. So, and that she underwent a transformation over time as a result of experience, and so did many other conservatives. So that essentially the leadership of the party remained Europhile, but underneath it, the rest of the party gradually became convinced it wanted to restore Britain's traditional independent statehood, our national sovereignty. And I think she would definitely have gone along with that decision.
What's the most important thing that Britain gains from Brexit, from an national independence?
I don't think there's any doubt about that, really, is that it is national independence itself is the biggest gain. The fact that you make decisions and other people don't make them on your behalf. That there is within British life now a really vigorous democratic debate. You don't have ministers coming along to the House of Commons and presenting European directives with which they may not have any sympathy, knowing that they present them to the House of Commons, and the House of Commons more or less has to accept them, because they're the new rules of the game in a member state of the European Union. So I think the fact that we restore democracy itself, that's the biggest advantage. I think in the long run, it will turn out to be an economic advantage as well, for this reason. Look at Greece. Greece is now in a terrible economic state, and it's kind of a debtor nation. It's in a debtor's prison. There doesn't seem to be much chance of it getting out of that debtor's prison. And that's because when it made a brave attempt to do so, its nerve, the nerve of the Greek government failed at the end, as Yanis Varoufakis, I think, very clearly outlined in his book. And they have accepted that they will be governed in future from Brussels. That's happened to all of the countries in the EU. And what that means is that other people make the economic decisions for them. And in the case of Greece, those decisions are very bad. In the case of Italy, there's been no growth for 2 decades. In the case of Portugal and Spain, you have youth unemployment figures in the something between the 20s and the 50s. So when you look at those circumstances, you say to yourself, if that happened in our country, the government would lose office and be replaced by another government. But there's no way that you can replace the European government under the existing system. People ask me, how does lacking democracy matter? I say, well, if you want to amend a law in Europe, how can you do it? You know, there's no point in setting up an anti-corn law league in Europe, because ultimately the European, the people running Europe don't need to pay attention to you, because you can't throw the rascals out.
John, I'd like to switch gears now and go to your current work. You're the head of the Danube Institute in Budapest in Hungary. And this has been somewhat controversial. It's attracted the attention of various writers and journalists who have sought to describe your presence there. I'm thinking of Annie Applebaum's recent book, memoir, in which she devotes this entire very small book to trying to paint the Hungarians and the Poles and various other nationalist democratic governments as authoritarian and totalitarian. And in the process, she also picks out a small number of, I guess, from her perspective, individuals who are enabling what she sees as the rise of authoritarianism. And you're singled out for the Danube Institute. You appear, I think there's 6 or 7 full pages in this small book, talking about how great a figure you were until you reached Hungary in 2013, and how far you've fallen since then. Can you tell us, from your perspective, what is the Danube Institute, and what is the work that you and Melissa are doing in Budapest?
Well, you know, Anne says in the in her book, and she seems to think that the Danube Institute is here in order to influence Hungarian politics. We are here really to plant the flag for a certain sort of conservatism. I mean, that was the terms in which I came, and that's the terms in which we've been working. Now, I always say 4 things about that. First of all, in economics, we believe in classical liberalism. You may want to dispute with me about that. In cultural questions, we believe in conservatism. And in foreign policy, we are firm, clear Atlanticists. Anne disputed that briefly in her book, but which surprised me, because, for example, we've had at least 2 conferences which we were doing in conjunction with NATO. And we have been consistently in favor of advancing the cause of NATO and of the Atlantic Alliance. We are not in any way anti-Western. So there are 3, so to speak, flags: conservatism, classical liberalism, and Atlanticism. But we also have been very careful not only to say, but to act on the principle that we believe in debate. We are here to plant these ideas, to argue them, to provide a kind of a transmission belt between the different countries of Central Europe and between Central Europe and the English-speaking world in particular, Western Europe too, but there are other institutions here which deal with Germany and France and so on. We've been particularly concerned to be a transmission belt of ideas and people between Western Europe, between the Anglosphere, Britain and America particularly, and Central Europe. So we haven't been in any way kind of advancing the interests of the government in domestic terms here, and they don't seem to have expected us to do so. So I don't think we've been in that regard, except in one particular case, which I'll now come to, We haven't been, in a sense, active in politics in a way that has anything to do much with the political interests of the Fidesz Party, and that is national conservatism. That's the distinction. Now, I think it's worth saying that until the end of the Cold War, and I would say for some years after that, the idea that conservatism wasn't about nationalism was an absurdity. It was an absurdity. If you looked at conservative parties anywhere, you could see that they had people who believed in free enterprise, people who believed, who were social traditionalists and believed in religion and certain kinds of public order. And finally, they believed in defending the nation state against external enemies and protecting it domestically as well. Anyone who came along, who went along to Margaret Thatcher or Ronald Reagan and said, you know, nationalism is not really part of your political identity, would have been seen as a crank. Now, when the Cold War was over, of course, a lot of major changes began to occur. And one of them was the attempt to create internationally forces in which decisions were increasingly going to be taken by institutions which were global in character, or certainly multinational in character. One was the European Union, but there were others as well. Now, as John Fonte and others have pointed out, there is a problem with transferring powers from democratic nation states to institutions which don't have democratic accountability. And so over a period of time, this was happening before, I think, a lot of conservatives, and I would include myself, realized this, that in a sense, the sovereign independence, the national sovereignty of countries like Britain and America was being increasingly, the example I gave was, it was like United States in particular was like Gulliver. When he wakes up on the beach, he's tied down by 1,000 little rules and regulations that the Lilliputians have imposed on him. And so international organizations were in effect attempting to take sovereignty away from nations and vest that sovereignty in themselves. Are you on the side of the nation state, the democratic nation state, or are you on the side of various global and globalizing institutions? And what's happened in Europe in recent years is that the electorates, both on the left and the right, have suddenly woken up to the fact that the parties that they had always supported, Conservative Party, Socialist, Social Democratic Party, the workers on the left suddenly realized we're no longer the constituency for the Socialist Party. They've now transferred their interests to global institutions and to those forces in the national life which are sympathetic to that transfer of power. And on the right, people who said we're patriots, we're believers in the nation, they've seen their party gradually shift to, let's say, in the case of Britain, to Europe. And that change has become tremendously important because it meant that electorates suddenly felt they were no longer in control. Now, at that point, what happens? In my view, what happens is that you have parties coming out and saying, look, we don't like this trend of events. We're losing control over our lives. The things that we believe in are despised. And this is being done by an elite which has transferred its own loyalty to international bodies or the EU or whatever. And that change is something that, it's something that has powered what's called populism in Central Europe, indeed in Italy and in Spain and elsewhere, and Brexit in Britain and Trump in the United States. That's the real row now that develops between people in politics. So I found myself saying, well, I'm a conservative, and like most conservatives, including the majority of the Tory party today, I would like democracy and national sovereignty, and that has been the cause, in a sense, I've most written about in the last few years.
Prime Minister Orban is certainly a crucial figure in any kind of a description of the rise of this nationalist conservatism or national conservatism. He is. You know, already in 2010, I think he had a reasonably well-developed views on the subject. And he has, because he's a man who reads books and likes to give speeches that have some degree of intellectual content in them as well, he has become some kind of an icon and a leader for people well beyond Hungary who are thinking about exactly the issues that you've been describing. Now, at the same time, he's obviously a target, and he's a target for accusations that he is in fact constructing an incipient dictatorship. We hear that that he has established circumstances in which no Hungarian opposition party can hope to win an election, circumstances in which he controls the media, circumstances in which he controls, or at least cows, the academic system and the courts and so on. You've heard all of these accusations. Would you be able to respond to them from your perspective?
I think the allegations you've just listed are either false or grotesquely or grossly exaggerated. Let me say two things about Orban and Fidesz, which I think have got to be understood. The first is that when people talk about populism, they give the impression that, and often rightly, as I just did, I think, that the Conservative Party has shrunk and a new populist party has risen on its right. And that party has now taken a big chunk of votes, not enough to win a majority general. Now, that's not true for Viktor Orban. Since starting the Fidesz party under communism and gradually and making it the vehicle for new democratic politics, he's taken his party on quite an interesting journey. And I'm not going to go through all of that journey, but the key point is this, that after he lost in 2002, when he was a conventional liberal conservative prime minister, he decided he had to work out what to do. And what happened was this. He made Fidesz a conservative party. And when the political system started to crack up a bit with voters from the communists and some of the socialists beginning to lose their voters, he essentially expanded his party to the right. He took populist energies and populist voters into the conservative party and made it a much broader based conservative party. He made it, in fact, what has the Tory party in Britain has traditionally been. The Tory party has traditionally included populist working class conservative voters. And he managed to do that by adding them to, in a sense, what you might think of as a bourgeois moderate conservative party. And he did that really in the period between 2006 and 2010. He won in 2010, and he's won two other elections since. So he is a politician who combines populist energies with conservative policies. And they include, of course, a strong defense of national sovereignty, and I would say also a wish to protect the traditional moral, national, and social and religious sympathies of the people. He doesn't want a politics to suddenly emerge. He doesn't want outsiders to come in and say, you've really got to change this country by making it more multicultural, by making it more secular, by transferring its powers to the center. So that's the most important, in a sense, realization you have to have about Orban's politics. It's a populist conservative politics, or a conservative populist politics. It's not just a populist politics, and that's part of its strength. Now, the other thing is, you must realize, is look at how he's done in elections since he's adopted this policy. He won basically the last three or four elections, including local and national, except for the most recent local elections. He's managed to have between 49% of the vote and 51%. Now, you don't get that without having genuine popular support. Nobody thinks it's rigged, by the way, and no serious person does. So what does it, why does he get it? Well, he gets it because he's governed the country quite well in the old-fashioned traditional sense that people feel safe, secure, they think their lives are getting better. They look at other countries nearby and they think, well, we're doing better than they are. So there is the sense that the country has been well governed. Secondly, economically, he has, until the recent pandemic, of course, he has also managed to improve the standard of living and prosperity every year. A friend of mine who's an economist here and a very strong critic of the government said to me with a kind of grimace, he said, these last 4 or 5 years will be regarded as Hungary's golden years. Now, you may think that the policies have achieved these things accidentally, but that doesn't matter to the voters if you make life better for them. The third was, on the big issue of the day, namely migration, he took a strong, bold stand, was admired as well as attacked for that bold stand by many people. But in Hungary, he was seen as someone who was protecting the nation's interests, their interests, and admired for that. Now, they're the reasons he won big. Can he lose? Of course he can. It's a fiction to think that he can't lose an election. I don't believe he thinks so himself, and it's being put about by his enemies. They don't believe it themselves. They, for example, recently won, and last year, they won, I think, 5 of the 10 major cities in local elections. At the moment, they are hoping that by banding together, in this case, the left and the extreme right banding together against Orban, they hope to win a by-election. I don't think they're going to manage it, but they may. But they certainly, in the last election, in the last few days of the 2018 election, they really thought they could possibly win on the night of the election because there was a huge turnout. And Orban's people knew that the turnout really reflected that they had managed to strike home with one or two key issues. But the left thought this was their own supporters turning out in huge numbers. So they don't believe that they can't defeat him. I think they can. I don't think they will next time. I think the odds are still on his side because he's continued in the pandemic to, I think, govern the country well. And these are not, in a sense, ideological reasons for his success. The reasons of practical political success, which people can recognize is happening. And so I'm inclined to de-emphasize, if I may put it this way, the ideological aspects of Orbanism and of Viktor Orban. They're important. But if he weren't actually governing the country well, making it more prosperous and handling problems like the pandemic effectively, he wouldn't be nearly so successful and he might have lost.
That's certainly legitimate to say. People keep focusing on the ideology, but the fact is that he governs very well. But I'm going to be guilty of the same sin. I'd like to push a little bit on the ideology. He's very explicit, much more so than most political figures are, that he is looking to create a model that is not liberal democracy. He explicitly uses terms like illiberal democracy, which of course, you know, to English speaking ears sounds terrible, but he also speaks of Christian democracy. I don't know if he's ever used the term conservative democracy, but that might also be able to fit to describe the kind of a worldview that he's describing, which is both democratic on the one hand, but also pursuing policies that are aimed at maintaining a strong religious tradition, a strong family life, which is actively encouraged by government policies, including subsidies for having children, very conservative policies on immigration that you were naming, and this combination of Christian conservative policies is in fact what attracts international attention to him and what attracts international opprobrium. Sometimes you get the feeling that people feel that they absolutely must see him as some kind of a dictator, the same way that they must see Trump as a dictator. And during the fight over Brexit, people had to ascribe fascism to figures like Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, absurd as that may be, but they did.
Anne does in her book. I mean, she describes Boris as authoritarian, and she was more or less the same thing about Simon Heffer. I mean, there's nothing about Boris Johnson that is authoritarian. I mean, he has battles with people, but I couldn't imagine why she reached that conclusion. Now, let's look at illiberal democracy for a second. There are lots of ways of looking at it. The first thing to say is that when I had a conversation about a week after he made that speech, when I ran in accidentally to the Prime Minister at a lunch, I said to him, I thought he'd made a mistake. He was objecting to the undemocratic imposition of liberalism in his policies. He was right to do that. But what he wanted was a democracy that wasn't, in a sense, didn't have liberalism as an imposition on it. And yet in all our lives in the last 20 or 30 years, the link between liberalism and democracy in the phrase liberal democracy has been one in which the power has shifted away from the democratic towards the liberal, away from institutions that are democratically accountable and towards institutions which are not accountable democratically and are generally controlled by liberal elites of one kind or another in the law or in business or elsewhere. He's since gone on to say that an illiberal democracy is a democracy that doesn't always elect liberals, and which has space for other parties. And my own view is this, and it's expressed not only by him, adopted not only by him, but also by Richard Legutko, the Polish philosopher politician. And that is that the democracy that we had, let's say, under Reagan and Thatcher, the democracy we had in the Second World War fighting against the Nazis under Roosevelt and Churchill, was a democracy in which the accountability of the government to the voters was very strong. And now that accountability has been diluted by the claims of by theoreticians that a democracy isn't really a democracy unless the courts have a very important say over the legitimacy of political decisions. It's not a democracy unless arrangements for the media are such that the government is, in a sense, forced to respond to the media all the time. I think that the concept of liberal democracy is a fine one, provided we realize that if you have free speech, if you have freedom of the press, if you have free inquiries, they're the things that liberal democracy requires. It is not necessary, as some of the economists have argued, for example, it is not necessary for liberal democracy to have an independent central bank. It may be a very good thing. It may be better than having a bank that, like the Bank of England until 20 years ago, was part of the government. I don't, rather not part of the government, but subject to government control. I think that we've got to realize that the reason why there's been a populist movement which has swelled, which occurred in Poland in particular and here, is because people feel that when a government announces a program, it's elected on it, it tries to implement it. We cannot have a situation in which that process is prevented from ending up in a new law because the EU doesn't like it or because the courts don't like it. Now, I know that the courts exist, constitutional courts exist to protect the Constitution, and that's right and proper. But if we look at the United States, do we really think that it is the right of the courts to completely revolutionize society, which is essentially what happened when we had the decision to move towards gay marriage? I would not be angry about adoption of gay marriage if it was done democratically. I might not want it, I might oppose it, but when it's imposed by a 5-4 majority in the Constitutional Court, a Supreme Court, I think one has to query whether that's democracy.
Well, I think the term liberal democracy is actually much newer than most people realize. I don't think that it had very much traction in the West up until the 1960s. It was coined during the 1930s in Germany and Italy, but not until the 1960s do you reach circumstances where liberalism as an ideology is considered to be absolutely essential to democracy. And just as you said a few minutes ago, what we end up getting is a view of democracy that says that democracy is legitimate only if it elects liberals. Now, Viktor Orban in Hungary does not see himself as a liberal because of his views on nationalism, because of his views on religion, because of his views on the family. I think he quite reasonably looks at what many Western countries have become, and he says, we in Hungary, we have other traditions, and we don't want to get there. And there's a difference between saying, I object to Viktor Orban because he's an authoritarian, and saying, I object to Viktor Orban because he's a conservative or because he's a national conservative. Which do you think it is?
Well, I think that he's a conservative who is attempting to protect the folk ways and the values and traditions of the Hungarian people. I don't think that, and I think, by the way, that in this society, as in other societies that we're talking about, the people adhere to an opposite point of view as well. I mean, the left in this country, when it has rallies and election campaigns, it tends to fly the European flag rather than the Hungarian flag. And that's the real distinction in the politics of this country at the moment. That may change. So I don't think that he's an autocrat. I mean, I think, as I say, I think he could lose the election. And I think that certainly one can raise objections to some of his policies, some of them on the grounds that I would like him to be a bit more liberal, perhaps. But I don't think, for example, that if you look at the press in this country, there's complete freedom of speech. In fact, the Hungarians would tell you that there is more freedom of speech in this country and in Central Europe than there is in politically correct countries, particularly the United States. The example that when Anne and I were talking about this, she would describe the conversation in the book, when she criticized Orban's, quote, control of the press, unquote, I pointed out that in fact there was far more, the Democratic Party in the United States had far more loyal and subservient journalists and newspapers and media stations than the Hungarian government has in Hungary. And when you look at the failure of the American media to report accurately, indeed to report at all, on certain on the riots and the demonstrations that have roiled the United States, it seems to me that if you were to come to this country and live here and see things, you would see a much more honest representation of reality in the Hungarian media. Is there some criticism? Yes, of course I have some criticism. For example, the official media is somewhat dull here, as it often is in government-controlled, when you have government official media. On the other hand, look at the BBC in England. It's very vibrant and lively, but the news is from a conservative standpoint, it hasn't yet reached the degree of uniformity, of a liberal uniformity you get in the United States, but there is certainly cause for and grounds for complaints that the conservatives simply don't get a look in. That's why at the moment the government is wondering whether or not to appoint Charles Moore to be the chairman of the BBC, because there's a sense that institutions like the BBC, like the universities, like the bureaucracy, like the quangos, that all of these are under the control of a certain social class, which is unsympathetic to the institutions, to the patriotism and to the values of most people. The basic point I'm making is, I think this is a free country, and that there are different points of view that are expressed. I think that there are things, as I say, I think I'd like to see a bit more relaxed. I personally think it's a mistake to have an official government channel, so to speak. They never really look good, and they're in every country in the world almost, but they tend to lack liveliness and spontaneity. And I think that, but otherwise, I think that I think it's free.
Let's, we're a few weeks now from what's going to be a pivotal American election, regardless of which way it goes, after an extremely extremely difficult summer of rioting across the United States. How do you see the changes that are taking place within American society at the moment?
We have to wait and see who wins the election. But there is no doubt that in the last 20 years, the possibility of something has become a practical likelihood. And that possibility is that the character of America could be undergoing a very remarkable change. When I went to America first to live in 1979, I was very quickly borne in on me how the Americans were not only patriotic, but they were constitutionally patriotic. For them, the American Constitution, its rules and regulations, was something real and living and something that they abided by. So that if you were having, as I did on several occasions, have conversations at dinner parties, I would make some argument and people would say, oh yes, well that is an interesting idea, but it's unconstitutional. And my initial response was to say, well, change the Constitution. But that was never a satisfactory response. And now it seems to me that I was a pioneer. There is something in America in which you have an entire political party, the majority of people in universities, the majority of people in the media, the majority of people in cultural institutions saying, look, this constitution, which is a liberal constitution in the 18th century sense, is too much of a burden. It's a straitjacket. We want to do things that that the constitution won't let us do, so we've got to get rid of it. And that's the choice that's being made now in this election campaign. I'm surprised that it's happened so quickly. There's a battle between people, between two Americas, an America that we live in, an America that doesn't yet exist, but which is struggling to do so. And that's now, that is now happening. And that's happening, excuse me. And it's happening for several reasons. But one of them is that the very lax immigration rules have changed the character of the electorate. They've introduced, obviously, talented and clever and brilliant people, but they've also introduced a lot of people who don't have that constitutional patriotism, don't fully understand it or feel sympathy towards it that I was describing before. So as a result, and the Democrats have seen this clearly, the Republicans have not properly seen it at all. As a result, we're finding that there are, so to speak, the foot soldiers of the revolution have come about by immigration. The officer class of the revolution has been created by the sons and daughters of the wealthy in going to universities, in which the kind of critical, we call it now critical legal analysis, critical race analysis, in which the a set of ideas which are hostile to the Constitution, and which seems to me come about from the arrival of extremely sophisticated intellectuals in the United States, who, in a sense, converted the United States to a suspicion of itself, and now to a kind of hostility to itself. I don't know what's going to happen, because obviously there are millions of people on both sides, but I have to feel that unless there is a victory, a clear victory for one side or another, followed by an attempt to conciliate the defeated, then America is in for a very bad bad future. And I say that as someone who admires America, believes in its resilience, but the next few years may be very turbulent, and I am worried about the country, I live in America when I'm not here. My wife is American. I have two American stepdaughters. And although I'm a loyal subject of Her Majesty the Queen, I have a great deal of love and affection for the United States.
John, is there anything that you can think of that would give us hope looking at the American political landscape at this critical moment?
The answer has to be yes, of course. But at the moment, I'd be far more inclined to warn than to soothe. The problem facing, I think, well, the Anglo-American democracies is that the leadership class has decided to abandon the traditional values and institutions of the society and replace them with someone else. But the masses of people, many of them are still, maybe a majority, are still attached to those values institutions and can't quite understand what is going on. Do we want America to be a divided society in the way that it has become, and not just divided, but passionately divided? I hope in those circumstances that people would come forward, and not necessarily just in politics, but in business and elsewhere. You know, the temperament of somebody like Amy Coney Barrett seems to be the kind of temperament I would like to see at the top of politics. She is a very impressive woman. She's very she has a clear point of view, but she's able to persuade people who have the opposite point of view to cooperate with her in trying to find a solution. That's my impression of her. very strongly, and it's confirmed by people who were at law school and have worked with her in the law from an opposite point of view. That kind of temperament is something which is needed in our politics now. And I don't see it. I mean, it doesn't, obviously Donald Trump doesn't have it. He has actually some very bad qualities, but some very remarkable ones. And he's undoubtedly a much more able political leader than anybody gave him credit for. And he's had the imagination to see in such matters as the as recognizing the capital of Israel should be Jerusalem, and going on to forge peace deals with between the Arabs and Israel. He's recognized opportunities that have been not just missed, but denied by less innovative politicians. So I'd like to be able to give you a clearer picture of hope in the United States and in Britain and elsewhere. I don't think it's possible to be optimistic. I think it's possible to have hope. The difference being that hope is a determination to solve the problems in ways that draw upon other people's virtue and hopefully your own. But at the moment, it's hope rather than optimism that we can apply to the problems of Britain and the United States. I think that they also require, I think they require patriotism. And I think that your arguments on nationalism and the nation are very important. And that's an intellectual argument that we need to win. It's not a political battle only. We have to, in a sense, give people back the vision of, so to speak, national neighborliness that they once had. They have had in key crises like the Second World War, terrible though they were, and saw nations through. We have to somehow rediscover that, just as we have to find leaders like Amy Coney Barrett, I mean, they're the things that I would hope for. I don't think what I've just said is very systematic, but I don't think there are systematic answers.
John O'Sullivan, thank you for joining us on NatCon Talk. Make sure you don't miss an episode of NatCon Talk. You can follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other podcast service near you. NatCon Talk is brought to you by the Edmund Burke Foundation and White House Writers Group. This program was produced by Yoram Chazoni and Anna Wellis. Associate producers Rafi Ice, Hadar Achiat Chazoni, and Eliasef Yehuda. Our special thanks to Alex and Kathy Cranberg and Colin Moran. Check out our website at nationalconservatism.org. You can find us on YouTube at National Conservatism, on Facebook at National Conservatism, and on Twitter at NatConTalk.